This is The Guardian.
Today, will panic at the petrol stations kill Bojo's mojo?
So Boris Johnson was travelling with journalists to New York. It was a big group of journalists on the trip because we were all, you know, dead keen to see him out and about for the first time in ages.
Heather Stewart, The Guardian's political editor, joined the Prime Minister when he flew to the UN General Assembly last week.
And what happens is you're travelling in the sort of back part of the plane, and then the Prime Minister is up the front in a sort of separate little compartment, no doubt quite a bit luxurious than where we're sitting. And Boris Johnson sort of comes bounding out.
Good afternoon, everybody. Fantastic to see you all here aboard this beautifully painted plane. Did you like it?
He stood there for a long time, you know, said how great it was to have us there.
It's great to see you. It's the first time we've been able to do a trip like this for ages now.
And lots of sort of on the front foot things to say about the climate crisis and levelling up, and talked about that as being sort of central to the purpose of his government, to move on beyond the narrative of COVID. And just his general mood was very upbeat.
But you didn't even have to be that close to see that Johnson was on his most rambunctious form, insulting the French.
Prenez un grip about all this, and donnez moi un break.
Invoking Kermit the Frog to deal with climate change.
Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." He was wrong. It is.
And even finally saying how many children he'd fathered.
You have six kids?
Yes.
All in all, Johnson had a spring in his step. But of course, prime ministers rarely get to set the tone for long. And as usual, events were getting in the way.
As petrol station stocks have run low, so tempers have run high. This man apparently pulling a knife in East London before ending up on the bonnet of the car.
You land back in the UK where you had people queuing at forecourts to get petrol, which was just a sort of extraordinary situation that, you know, none of us can remember for a generation, really.
I've been to six petrol stations, different locations, none whatsoever.
So it was straight back from this sort of bestriding the global stage into a situation where there was a real sense of urgency, and he flipped from...
Yes, there are a lot of short-term problems.
Don't worry, you know, this is a worldwide problem, market forces will sort it.
But this will get better as the market starts to sort itself out.
But by the time we landed back in the UK, it was pretty obvious that wasn't the case.
No fuel anyway, we don't know what to do.
I don't know, government should do something ASAP.
And the government did.
Tonight, the army has been put on standby.
Eventually bringing in the army. But energy companies are still going bust. Petrol's still in short supply, and instead of a victory lap, Boris Johnson is heading to conference in Manchester with yet another situation on his hands. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the crisis that could crush Boris Johnson's conference dreams. Heather Stewart, you're The Guardian's political editor. I know you're in one of the busiest parts of your year, which is conference season. How are you coping?
Is it a bit sad to say I'm really enjoying it? I think if you ask me again at the end of Tory party conference, the answer might be different. But at the moment, I'm actually really enjoying it because it's so nice to be out in the world. And, you know,
sound elated. I thought you'd be really weary and exhausted.
Well, a lot of the interesting bit of our job happens in the little bits at the edges of conversations. The person who draws you aside at the end of a meeting and has a little something extra to tell you. The person that you grab as you pass them on the street and just have a little two-minute chat with them. The body language, the whispering, the gossip, the chatter. You can't do any of that on Zoom. And so it's been really quite refreshing to get back to what really feels like, you know, doing the job properly in a sort of human way.
And so now this is an actual live in-person conference which starts on Sunday. But to set the scene for that and to understand what Boris Johnson wants to get out of it, we do need to go back a couple of weeks, don't we?
The rumour mill's been in overdrive for days.
Who's in, Prime Minister? Planning
coming big changes?
We need to talk about the massive cabinet reshuffle.
I think you see the panto season has just come early.
Johnson got rid of ministers who've been seen to be failing at their jobs. People like Gavin Williamson as Education Secretary, Dominic Raab as Foreign Secretary. Heather, why did Johnson finally decide that this was the time to wield the axe?
So I think they felt this was a real reset moment. It's kind of a pivot from talking about COVID to, I suppose, politics as usual a little bit. You know, they won a lot of seats in 2019 with people who were perhaps former Labour voters. They're acutely conscious they've got to have something to offer those voters. And so this was a reshuffle, I think, aimed at trying to achieve that. It really seemed to me like a reshuffle that was sort of laying the groundwork for the next election. He doesn't like doing them. He doesn't do them very often. He doesn't love having difficult conversations with people, notoriously. He tends to sort of avoid conflict and, you know,
We hear this, that he avoids conflict, but he's also pretty, like, ruthless when it comes down to it, no?
Yeah, this was a ruthless reshuffle, right?
Sacked so far, Gavin Williamson.
So Gavin Williamson, for a long time, he'd become a sort of public joke.
Leaving government after presiding over a chaotic period for school children during the pandemic.
And yet you had lots of briefing in the run-up, which may or may not have been emanating from somewhere near Gavin Williamson himself, suggesting he'd be given some other post. Perhaps he would return to his old job as chief whip because he knows where the bodies are buried in the Tory party. And in the event, nope, off he goes back to the backbenches.
Gone to Housing Secretary Robert Jenrick and Robert Buckland also sacked.
The same with Robert Buckland, the Justice Secretary, who, you know, was seen to be doing a pretty good job by a lot of Conservative MPs, quite a sort of solid, hard-working chap, and because they needed to find a place for Dominic Raab, who they were moving out of the Foreign Secretary post.
Dominic Raab fast to the door, keeping a cabinet seat, but not as Foreign Secretary. Instead, he moves to Justice.
Off goes Robert Buckland, complete surprise to him. So it was quite a robust and quite a sort of ruthless clear-out, I think, in the end.
So when you looked at the list of ministers who were appointed in their place, what's the thinking behind the ministers that he's chosen?
I mean, Nadine Dorries, who he's put in as Culture Secretary, you know, we were all very quickly digging up tweets that she had sent in the past where she was incredibly rude about the BBC and talking about snowflakes. And she is definitely of that sort of anti-woke, political correctness gone mad kind of strand of the Tory party. I think the Tories rather like the idea that, you know, she's a best-selling novelist. She makes a lot of money out of her books.
She's an author. She's sold thousands and thousands of books.
Sort of heartfelt tales about Liverpool nurses.
You know, what's great about Nadine Dorries is she produces culture that people buy and actually want to see rather than some of the more crackpot schemes we've seen being funded in the past by taxpayers' money.
They quite like the idea they've got someone in there who, you know, is not a sort of highbrow, liberal arts type person, but represents a different kind of culture, a kind of popular culture. She was on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. It's not something any other culture secretary can boast.
Well, when someone asked me, would you go into the jungle with snakes and rats? I thought, that's Westminster, I work there.
Okay, I think I need to come out.
If you want to come out, you've got to say the words.
Oh, I'm supposed to get me out of here.
All right, let's get you out.
Whether she will pick a lot of fights in this job, because she is a culture warrior, it will be very, very interesting to see.
You know, before this crisis started, the Prime Minister gave mental health £2.4 billion.
Certainly people who work with her in health said she came in and they thought she might be, you know, quite difficult to deal with, and actually she sort of knuckled down and did a kind of fairly low-key job.
Well, the Prime Minister has put in place a strong and united team.
And Liz Truss's promotion was completely fascinating, I think.
And I'm delighted to be appointed Foreign Secretary to promote a positive outward vision of global Britain.
So she is wildly popular in the Tory party. The regular polls that the website Conservative Home do of Tory members, grassroots members, she almost invariably comes out on top. They love her.
My guest today is an ardent Brexiteer, a free marketeer, and someone who's never shy about telling it like it is. International Trade Secretary and Minister for Women and Equalities, Conservative MP Liz Truss. Welcome.
She is also a kind of woke warrior, and she does keep the equalities brief. So it will be interesting to see what she does on some of those issues, trans rights and so on. You know, you could argue it's pretty problematic having someone who is Foreign Secretary, which anybody would think was a full-time job, who's sort of keeping the equalities brief on the side. That seems pretty extraordinary and a kind of downgrading of its importance.
So is it fair to say that, given that some of these selections are hardcore culture warriors, that it makes you think, or it makes one think, that Johnson is trying to get the party onto a war footing?
I don't think that is a huge strand of their electoral strategy, actually. I definitely think there are people around Johnson who really believe that stuff and sort of promulgate it.
You've got a unit in Downing Street headed by a married couple, Doug Smith and Muneera Mirza. They exist to promote these culture wars.
Muneera Mirza, Dougie Smith, Tory advisers who think it should be a big part of the Conservative strategy to sort of pursue a kind of culture war, to keep picking these fights.
Now to a debate that's been rumbling on for many months.
Former Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden did over statues.
He's accused a London hospital, Guy's, of pandering to wokery after it decided to remove a statue of Thomas Guy because of his links to slavery.
There was some suggestion that Kemi Badenoch, for example, might be Education Secretary, so she's seen as a real sort of anti-woke voice, you know, a culture warrior.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm pleased to be standing here at the dispatch box.
And they would have liked to see Badenoch in that post because she could then have sort of taken the fight to the teachers, you know, this idea that teachers are sort of, you know, terrible lefties who are inculcating their pupils with, you know, crazy woke ideas. However, he didn't go for that.
I'm just hearing a Nadeem Zahawi Education Secretary.
Okay.
He went for Nadeem Zahawi, who is seen as a sort of solid, capable minister, quite low-key, has managed the vaccine rollout well, is perceived to have done so.
The vaccination programme in England alone has prevented 52,600 hospitalisations.
And, that, you know, communicates well and is not likely to pick a great fight with teachers. And you know, Truss hasn't been put as Foreign Secretary to fight a culture war. She's been put as Foreign Secretary to sort of, you know, make Britain look good on the world stage, make trade a more important part of our foreign policy, and also, you know, potentially keep us slightly out of the way because she's a potential leadership candidate. And it's a classic thing to do with your rivals is to send them off around the world so that, you know, they're not necessarily in your face the whole time.
Speaking of rivals, there's the major name, the big beast that we haven't mentioned yet, Michael Gove, who became Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities. And I guess the first and most obvious question is, what exactly is a Minister of Levelling Up supposed to do?
Well, I think part of the role Michael Gove has been given is to answer that question, right? We've been promised a white paper on this issue. I'm told there were drafts floating around Whitehall already. And all the flesh the Tories have put on the bones of that so far is sort of, we'll do some infrastructure, we might build some transport links, we might give a bit of money to your local town to do up your high street. But the problem of inequalities between different areas in the UK economy, and it's been a problem that everyone has known about for decades, you know, probably sort of 50 years. There isn't really a sense, it seems to me, that there's any kind of thoroughgoing assessment of what you would really need to do to change that. So I think it will be really interesting to see what that policy is when they set it out properly.
Mr. Gove has a record in Whitehall as a problem solver and a doer.
But I do think there's a strong sense of putting Michael Gove in there because this is an area they know they have to have something to show on before the next election. And specifically, they need to have something to offer those voters in, you know, call them what you like, red wall areas, left behind areas, former industrial heartlands, those areas. They want something to point to say, you know, this is what we've done for you. The Tories are also looking over their other shoulder, I think. This idea of the blue wall has started to be talked about.
They could have invented the phrase true blue for places like Chesham and Amersham.
The sense that there is disquiet among quite a lot of traditional Tory voters, I suppose you would call them.
Conservative in one way or another since universal suffrage.
Across the southeast in commuter towns and places like that.
But no longer. Lib Dem Sarah Green took the seat last night on one of the biggest swings seen to the party in the last 30 years.
About things like radical planning reforms, you know, they were worried the government was going to sort of concrete over the green belt and so on. And housing, planning is a huge issue. That's a sort of hot potato that's been handed to Michael Gove, and he's got to try and find a way through it, but without alienating a great swathe of the Tory electoral coalition. So I think he's got a really difficult job on his hands there.
What do you think it says about Johnson's view of his own position that he's willing to appoint quite a notable rival to a job that people are going to judge the government on?
So it suggests that he does trust Gove because it's crucial to his sort of model of how to win the next election. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem like a great job from which to build a sort of power base. You know, Rishi Sunak can use being Chancellor to build up his public profile. He's got a great Instagram game. There he is, kind of creating jobs and handing out money. It's quite hard to see someone doing the nitty-gritty job of levelling up able to put themselves in a position to be a sort of winning candidate at a leadership election in quite the same way.
So you mentioned Rishi Sunak there, and he is the other big figure that we have to talk about. He's kept his job. He's still Chancellor of the Exchequer. And he's said to be unsackable. Is that because he and Johnson are the best of friends?
No, I don't think they are. I mean, I think personally, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak get on well. I think they have quite different perceptions of what conservatism is and what a conservative government should do. You know, Boris Johnson has a quite sort of short-termist approach, which is if there's a problem, you chuck money at it. Whereas Rishi Sunak, and to some extent, it's the traditional role of a chancellor, right? But he has his hands on the purse strings. He talked last year in his own Tory party conference speech about the sort of duty to balance the books, to you know, steward the public finances responsibly, because he, you know, he's increasingly worried, I think, that Johnson tends to sort of go on a splurge first. So they are on quite different pages on this stuff, I think. And also, of course, remember, Johnson will no doubt see Rishi Sunak as a rival. You know, he's very popular. He's popular with the public. He's popular with party members.
And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome the Right Honourable Rishi Sunak.
And he's very, very good at self-promotion.
What's the exercise routine? You're a very active person, Rishi. I know you're a Peloton man.
He goes around talking about how many Peloton classes he's done.
Yeah, so I you know, it's been destroyed, my exercise routine, by this job.
You know, the diet that he's on.
That's the vote winner, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Extraordinary physical ability.
Probably one session on Peloton, one session on the treadmill, and then one HIIT class.
You know, he does government programmes and then has sort of branded hoodies made to promote them. And, you know, I mean, it's all sort of slightly cringe at one level, but, you know, it's pretty effective.
So, Heather, that's the picture within the government. But there is this other big group giving Johnson a massive headache as he tries to turn the page on Brexit, on the pandemic. And that's his own backbenchers. Can you explain what he's dealing with there?
Yeah, that's been one of the surprises of this parliament, or of the what we've had of this parliament so far, to me, I think, because there have been a whole series of issues on which Tory backbenchers have been really, really restive and quite openly opposed the government.
But the problem with these proposals, the problem with this algorithm on housing numbers, is that it doesn't guarantee a single extra home being built.
I mean, the sort of Theresa May gang, I would put in a sort of One Nation Tories or Blue Wall Tories. Jeremy Hunt is kind of in that group. Damien Green. They often represent sort of southern seats, traditional Tory seats, and are concerned about issues like planning and so on.
Sticking rigidly to spending 0.7% of our national income on overseas aid is difficult to justify to the British people.
And aid is another issue that they've sort of coalesced around.
But today, a group of Conservative MPs who were determined to overturn that decision will join with Labour and others to push for a vote in Parliament, and they believe they have the support to force Boris Johnson's hand.
And of course, there's also the COVID recovery group, they call themselves.
And, you know, for those of us who are representing real people with real suffering.
Mark Harper chairs that. He's a former Tory chief whip.
Thing. So on vaccine passports, I oppose them and I will vote against them.
Who have been very sceptical about lockdowns, very worried about vaccine passports, for example, see that as an infringement on liberty.
Steve Baker, welcome to Acting Prime Minister, and thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm absolutely delighted to have this opportunity to drop myself in trouble.
Steve Baker is part of that group, ardent Brexiter, of course, and in fact had even said that he might boycott Conservative Party conference if he was going to have to show that he'd been vaccinated in order to go. And you've also got the Red Wallers, the 2019 intake, plus a few other Tory MPs who represent those kinds of former industrial seats or northern seats. They've formed themselves into a northern research group. Jake Berry chairs that, former minister, former Boris Johnson supporter.
Good morning.
Is national insurance the right tax to use?
Well, no, I don't think it is, actually. And really, for
now, quite a vocal critic of some aspects of the government's policy, and certainly they have opposed, for example, the universal credit cut.
Ministers have said that it will end at that date because to keep it in place permanently would cost around £6 billion a year. Yet there is growing opposition to this in Parliament, and not only from the opposition, but from Conservatives as well.
So they're different, disparate groups, but there is a sense that there are kind of, you know, caucuses on the back benches of vocal MPs. Quite a lot of them have ministerial experience, people who have done big cabinet jobs, who are kind of senior party figures, who were very, very happy to sort of speak out publicly. And that's quite an interesting situation. I think Johnson just doesn't particularly command the loyalty of quite a few of his own sort of senior party figures. So he does have to think about managing his own parliamentary party and in the way that a prime minister with an 80-seat majority would normally not expect to.
So We've seen another big test of that relationship between backbenchers and Johnson recently.
Boris Johnson is facing a backlash from MPs returning to Parliament today over plans for reforming the funding of social care and the NHS in England.
Which was the announcement of social care reform and the plan to fund it with a big tax rise.
Many, including prominent Conservatives, are angry about reports that he's considering raising national insurance rates, which would break a manifesto pledge.
What did it tell us about Johnson's authority?
It was interesting, actually. In a way, it showed him flexing his muscles, because in the run-up to this, we knew that there were cabinet ministers who had concerns about it. Lots of backbenchers had concerns about it.
They can't seriously be thinking about a tax raid on supermarket workers and nurses so that the children of Surrey homeowners can receive bigger inheritances. That arresting line from an unnamed cabinet minister in The Telegraph sets the scene for a battle the Prime Minister has to have now with some of his own supporters.
And yet, when it came to it, the plan was sort of presented to them as a fait accompli. It had been hammered out between Johnson, Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid. And there were some squeaks in cabinet. I think a couple of people raised concerns, but in the end, they were able to issue a statement saying that agreement had been reached. They rushed it through the Commons. They put a vote through the next day.
The ayes to the right, 319. The noes to the left, 248. So the ayes have it, the ayes have it, unlocked.
And then passed the bill the following week. So it was a real sort of party management operation. It was sort of sprung on them. It came very quickly. And it did show you that, well, there were all these rumblings about all kinds of issues. Ultimately, if the Prime Minister and the Chancellor decide they're going to go ahead with something, the party falls into line.
Coming up, what can we actually expect from this year's conference? And could it foreshadow, dare I say it, another general election? Heather, all of this makes me extremely anxious about the very last thing most people want to have to go through ever, which is another election. More and more we're seeing talk that Boris Johnson is starting to think about that and when he should call the next one. And given that it could be next year, it hardly seems any time since the last one, but can you give it to me straight? Do you think that's actually likely to happen?
So I was talking to a Labour shadow cabinet person today who was saying they think they have to be ready for 2022. 2022 doesn't feel that likely to me. Would you call an election 5 or 6 months after people haven't been able to get petrol from the forecourt and you've had to go on the telly and say there isn't a crisis? I would say that seems unlikely. And also, I don't think you would put people in those jobs. So put Oliver Dowden, for example, very trusted aide in as Conservative Party chair, to prepare for an election that's just 6 months away. 2023 feels a bit more likely to me. So when you ask people in Number 10, they say, absolutely not, we're going long. You know, 2024, we've got plenty of time. You know, we need to show that we can deliver. It'll depend a lot on what state they think the Labour Party is in, on what they think they can show those red wall voters, and on, of course, the economic situation. You know, if we start to get runaway inflation, if we start to get a cost of living crisis where people are struggling with their fuel bills and facing tax rises and suffering from the universal credit cut, it'll matter a lot to them what the backdrop is economically, what the polling situation is. But if I was a betting woman, I would say at this point, 2023 to me looks more likely than next year. But, you know, a lot can change, as we know.
OK, back to the nearer future. Conference starts on Sunday. We know how much political parties invest in that leader's speech. Apart from levelling up, has he got big ideas to sell?
Something that he kept talking about in answer to various questions when we saw him in the US, which made you think it was uppermost in his mind, was the idea that the Conservatives want to see the UK transition from being a low-wage, low-skill economy to a high-wage, high-skill economy.
The key focus for this government is on making sure that we come out of COVID strongly with a jobs-led recovery.
So he and his colleagues think that one of the impacts of Brexit will be that instead of having this sort of reserve pool of potentially low-cost workers who could sort of flow in and out from anywhere in the EU, we've got a bit more control over it, and that should force companies to employ British workers and people will be paid better potentially, and you know that's a good thing. So he'll want to point to the sort of sunlit uplands of Brexit to give people a sense of how Brexit has made the world a better place, which has been really difficult to get any kind of sense of, let's face it, over the last couple of years. So I'm sure there will be a bit of that, and we're proud of Britain and we're going to make it a better place and we're going to be green. And, you know, I think there's a real sense that Boris Johnson wants to go back to being his sort of natural boosterish self.
What's so interesting about that is that it just sounds like the version of Johnson you were getting on that flight to New York. And now, instead, it feels like this dismal situation at home has hijacked his plans.
Yeah, we come into conference at an extraordinary time, really, where the government is having to deal with this fuel crisis, which is obviously, it's a kind of bubbling up of post-COVID, but also post-Brexit problems that economists and other sort of experts tell you are going to be happening in all kinds of bits of the economy in the weeks and months ahead. So shortages of all kinds of workers, shortages in supermarkets, fruit and flowers being unpicked in the fields, and all kinds of issues that, you know, he's going to have to tackle. And it'd be very interesting to see whether what they hope will be the agenda at conference will end up being sort of sidelined by the crisis going on out there in the world.
Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Heather Stewart, The Guardian's political editor. You can keep up with all the very latest twists and turns of conference season at theguardian.com. And do catch up with the Politics Weekly team next Wednesday. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.